everyone. This is Chris, and you're listening to the Live Fix Podcast, the podcast that explores the concert fan experience. We believe live music is life-altering. Join us as we share stories and connect with concert fans to discover how live music forever rocks our world before, during, and after the show. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the episode. Concerts so immersive? Is it possible to measure how emotionally immersed you are at a concert and why? Can artists, venue owners, and event promoters use immersion neuroscience to make the concert experience more memorable? Can they use that data to predict concert sales, plan tours, and create a more loyal fan base? Can concert fans use the data and insights from immersion neuroscience to decide which artists we should see next? On this episode, we talk with neuroscientist, author, and TED Talk speaker, Dr. Paul J. Zak, and we dive into why immersion plays such a powerful role in our concert experiences. Dr. Zak founded the first neuroscience as a service company called Immersion Neuroscience. The Immersion platform empowers anyone to measure what the brain values second by second in real time, any place people are doing interesting things. Dr. Zak's immersion clients use his platform to assess and improve marketing, customer experiences, employee performance, training, education, and emotional health. Dr. Zak is also the author of the recent book Immersion, The Science of the Extraordinary and the Source of Happiness. In his book, he explores why immersion offers a framework for transforming nearly any situation from ordinary to extraordinary. Based on over 20 years of neuroscience research from his lab, and innumerable client applications, Dr. Paul Zak explains why brains crave the extraordinary. His work and his book really got me thinking about how the connection is between immersion and the live music experience. You can't have one without the other. So we really wanted to dive in and ask him about this. So in this episode, we asked Dr. Paul about his favorite concert experiences and how immersion played a role in those. We also asked him for some tips and suggestions on how fans, bands, and venue owners can really get the most out of and really use immersion in all these experiences. We also discuss how concert fans can help Dr. Zak with his ongoing immersion research. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to have you as a guest on the Live Fix Podcast. Thanks for being here.
Of course, it's a pleasure.
Yeah, I wanted to start off by giving you an opportunity to talk about what is immersion. I know we've really enjoyed going through your book and learning more about what you've talked about, and I wonder if you could start off by telling us a little bit about what immersion is before we get into, you know, and also kind of set the stage for some of our concert focused immersion part of the conversation and kind of tell us a little bit about what immersion is.
Great question. So you probably haven't been to a really bad concert, but you certainly have seen bad movies. You see bad ads all the time on YouTube. Probably, Chris, you've been to some classes that just put you to sleep. What's the deal on that? So here's some data on that. 80% of Hollywood movies have lost money for the last 30 years. Like, how is that even possible, right? How have we not learned anything about what is great and what's not when it comes to entertainment? Or again, for that matter, education or a customer experience. So immersion is a neurologic state that my research uncovered over many years that captures the value that the brain gets from experiences. So it's an objective way to measure how much people enjoy an experience neurologically.
And you've done tons and tons of research and had tons of test subjects and a lot of money went into some of your research. What personal experiences actually led you to starting to conduct this experience, this research in immersion?
Yeah, thanks, Colleen. Shortly after the tragedy of 9/11, I was asked and did help the government in several different ways with the war on terror. And as part of that, I would attend conferences sponsored by the Department of Defense. And after I gave a short presentation on some new research in my lab, this is the early 2000s, a dude who introduced himself as Ron Wilson, I'm putting that in air quotes, got about 3 inches from my face. And he said, "I investigate terrorists for a living. I need that stuff tomorrow." And I'm like, "Whoa, dude, what's happening here?" And I had just presented research from my lab about a neurochemical called oxytocin that we had shown caused you to trust strangers, want to cooperate with others, increased empathy. And this guy from some intelligence agency thought it would be a very effective way to get information out of potential terrorists. So turns out the world's a lot more complicated than that. There's no one-to-one mapping in the brain. But eventually, I was funded by various agencies of the U.S. government that tasked me with identifying signals in the brain that in combination would consistently and reliably predict what people would do after a message or an experience. And so this led to millions of dollars of funded research and building a test bed for the military so they could test messages that they could send to our foreign either allies or enemies to try to get them to cooperate with us. And then, Colleen, the honest answer is, I am a cheap bastard and neuroscience is expensive. And so at some point, companies started coming to my door with a suitcase full of money and saying, "Hey, we read about you in the media and you have some way to measure how good something is second by second, how much people's brains value this objectively. And we want to create better customer experiences, better advertising, better corporate training, and better live events. And so could you help us?" And so we said, "Sure. I have 19 PhDs in my lab. I have these $100,000 machines. And if you give us 3 months, you know, we can do that." And some people did. And then we realized that they were super happy with the results, but never, ever asked us to help them again because they burned their whole budget on one study. So he said, "Well, if this is really what the world needs, we really need to measure what people's brains really value, what really makes us happy, then gosh, we should figure out a way to make this available to everybody." So we got rid of the big machines. We got rid of the 19 PhDs. We automated all the signal processing in the cloud and were able to pull data from smartwatches and fitness sensors and you know, allow anyone who's creating content to see how good it is second by second, to edit it, to make it better, to see who loves it, who hates it. So it's been a very interesting ride to bring this out into the world.
And changing lives in the process, it sounds like.
Hopefully. I mean, we're really moving into the experienced economy. This is the space you guys are in, where increasingly people want to do more stuff rather than have more stuff. So if I'm going to do more stuff, I really want that stuff to be fabulous. I don't want to, you know, make a big investment to go to Costa Rica or to learn how to skydive or rock climb and then have it really be sucky for a whole variety of reasons that could be sucky. You know, I think measurement's the key here. So as you all know, if you ask people, particularly if it's an experience they haven't had before, you know, "What do you think about this?" They can't really articulate consciously their unconscious emotional responses to an experience. And that's why we have 80% of movies losing money, because you go to a screener for a movie when they're going to edit it and they say, you know, "What do you like?" Liking to me and immersion are really different things. Liking is this conscious, filtered, want to be nice, am sort of guessing what I think, where immersion comes out of the brainstem. It's well below conscious awareness. It's objective. It is granular. You know, I can get it every second out of your brain. And once we have that tool, then we can actually create great experiences. You know, education is a real passion of mine. When I saw my kids in Zoom school, it was horrendously bad. It was mostly time wasting, partially for the, you know, way schools get paid. But also I thought, you know, a lot of this is just god-awful boring. Why don't we just make everything great by measuring and improving it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, your book, you know, I'm reading through it and just, you know, following your work and preparing for this conversation. I was like, man, what about live music? Right. Cause you mentioned earlier that we haven't been to any bad shows, and I would say we have, you know, and I go, wow, like, why was that terrible? You know, and you know, over the course of, you know, our careers and experiences, you know, I've reviewed, been to hundreds of shows, and good ones, bad ones, great performances, terrible performances.
Scary ones.
Yeah, scary ones, ones where I feel close to my fellow fans, ones where I feel close to the artist, you know, the music, you know, I feel, you know, a sense of community, a sense of being almost, you know, lifted up off the floor, because it's, you know, I think I've used that word before, you know, I feel immersed in the moment, you know, or the time has stopped, right? And that, right, that concert moment, you know, so I was just like, well, you know, like what is about that, right? And even today, in the importance of your work, I know in your book, you talk about music, and being able to, you know, the prediction of a hit song, or looking at, you know, how do we do this for the music industry? And I know there's a reduction of the amount of money that could be made with recorded music mm-hmm. today. Artists aren't going to be making as much money, or actually they don't anymore, as much as they did for recorded albums as they do for their live show, right? They have to tour in order to make money. And that got me thinking about the importance of your work, and having been to a lot of great shows myself, but been to a lot of poor shows, I was wondering how you see immersion helping the music industry and artists themselves, you know, make a great show, right? And I think that's
provide that experience,
right? Like, what are your thoughts about, you know, that beyond, you know, just recorded the immersion in the recorded music, but immersion in the live music experience? Seems like that's such an important thing now and for the future of the music industry.
Yeah, for sure. So I want to take that on a couple different ways, Chris. It's a big topic, and I'm going to say I'm going to talk about the neuroscience of this, and there's lots of other components that I don't know about. So I think the first question is why we actually show up at concerts at all, right? I can just download the song. I can watch the concert video. So I think you put your finger on it, first of all, that there's something really powerful about being in community while we're seeing a live show. And we have found that in our subscriber use of our platform Immersion, that almost without exception, when you add a social layer to an experience, you increase its immersion. So a class on Zoom by yourself in your room is not as good as generally a class where you're shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of other people. Watching a concert video by yourself, even with a couple people, is not the same as being in a stadium with, you know, 30,000 other people with a live show. And so that's the first thing, is that we are social creatures. We kind of gain energy. Immersion is metabolically costly. So when we see immersion, we see the brain is really processing this information. It's like, this is the best thing. It's putting a lot of energy into that. And the brain doesn't want to spend a lot of energy. It's so expensive to run your brain full tilt that most of the time we just want to idle. So yeah, so it's that community is really important. The second thing you mentioned, and I'll just expand on from the book, is that it turns out that we know a good song within the first minute. If it's a brand new song you haven't heard before, it might even be shorter than that, but a minute is as short as we went. You don't need to hear the whole song. You can actually very accurately, sorry, not consciously, but your brain knows by measuring not only immersion, but the peaks in immersion. Like, is it really, really wonderful in the first minute if this song is going to be a hit or a miss? When you look at things like Spotify streams or Pandora streams or whatever service you're on. So we sort of know from the get-go. So these data kind of led me to think of three dimensions through which artists can create a better experience. And I'm going to really talk about live experiences, but you could easily adapt this to recording as well. The first is preparing the audience. So we think about a concert. You know, there may be a warm-up show, and then there's generally kind of a break, right? There's a break in which the lights come up, you can walk around, use the bathroom, get a drink, and then the lights come down. We have this kind of moment of silence. So because immersion is metabolically costly, right, that readiness, that preparation really sets us up to have an amazing experience. And then most concerts I've been to, you know, really start with a bang. I don't want to start with, you know, some, you know, I don't know, deep cut from, you know, an album 20 years ago. generally start with something that's, you know, gonna, you know, rock people out, because you've been waiting all this time. You parked your car, bought a ticket, you know, walked in and found your seats, and, you know, spending a lot of money. So you want to hit them hard. So it's important in this readiness to really open hot. But then the two other dimensions are the content itself, the songs themselves. And the third is the delivery of those songs, right? So I haven't been to a concert like this, but if we had, you know, some concert by, say, a very famous group, and they were just out of it, and they were, I don't know, low energy, and, you know, it's just, you know, not going to be great. So one of the last concerts I went to pre-COVID was the Rolling Stones. It's a bit pre-COVID. And, you know, Mick Jagger's like 1,000 years old, and man, he just killed it in the rain outdoors in San Diego. Didn't care, you know, just killed it for 2.5 hours. And like, man, this guy is in great shape. The whole band was in great shape. So, you know, that's what you kind of expect. And so immersion is contagious. It's capturing the social interaction between people. That's why the social layer, having more people, increases it. But I also absorb it from the band, and the band absorbs it from us, by the way, right? So if that audience is really into it, they're clapping, they're standing up, they're dancing, they're making noise. Well, that band's really picking up that energy. And so, you know, if you read, you know, about artists after a concert, generally, they can't go to sleep right away, right? They are amped up. They've absorbed all that energy. They've expended energy, but also absorbed all that energy from the audience. And so we do the same thing. We're at concerts. We're absorbing all that energy from the band and from all those people around us, which is just amazing. So it's kind of this weird social energy transfer, but it taps into these core needs as human beings. One is, as you said, Chris, to be in community. But the second is to have these profound emotional experiences. They're extraordinarily important, not only to our acute happiness, but as I discussed in the very end of the book, when we have these peak immersion experiences, we begin to train our brains to be present and to be emotionally open. And those are things that increase the quality of our relationships, and relationship quality increases our health, our happiness, and the length of life. And those are all things that we want. So concerts, yay, concerts, you know, building up that neurologic muscle. So now I have an amazing, you know, story to tell. I can connect with my friends, with my loved ones, because my brain was really, you know, kind of firing on all cylinders.
That's fantastic. I think one of the questions I had too about you, you mentioned this in your book, and you're kind of hitting on just a moment ago, was the things that we bring to the concert, but also how to measure the level of immersion and that peak immersion moment. And I was wondering if what you're doing with immersion factors in what people bring to that baseline. That moment, right? Because mm-hmm. then we ask, and one of the things we explore a lot on, you know, within the podcast is, the before, what you're bringing to the concert has an impact on the actual concert. And then once you leave, right, you're this transformed person, right? Or, you know, you're part of this community that's just been transformed. And with immersion, I was really wondering about how does the, you know, what's happened before the concert impact that? And do you measure that? Does immersion, you know, and that peak moment that you get to, play into the measurement of that? Cause I'd have to imagine it does, but I would love to hear you talk about that. Cause it seems like something that would impact, or if you rule that out, but how does that before and what you bring in factor into measuring immersion?
So Chris, I'm holding up a piece of paper that says A+. That's an A+ neuroscience question. Right. So we've actually done a lot of research in this. And the nice thing about having a platform anybody can use to measure immersion is that I can't think of every interesting question, but every day, you know, organizations, individuals are asking just the questions you're asking. And what those data show is that when that piece of content is relevant to me, then it increases immersion. So the mechanism in the brain is called top-down control. So the top of the brain, the outer part of the brain called the cortex, directs the lower parts of the brain that are primarily processing emotional, social and emotional information to expend more energy on this when it's meaningful or important to me. So I'm 61 years old, so I'm ancient. So I'm a classic rock guy. So I see the Rolling Stones, I see Eric Clapton. Man, that's my stuff. I remember that from high school. I remember that from college. I am loving it. You take me to a, I don't know, Eminem
Taylor
concert.
Swift? Taylor Swift?
Yeah, Taylor Swift. Yeah, not my thing, right? And so I recognize that Taylor Swift has an amazing voice, so no question about it. But it's just not my kind of music. And so, yeah, it just doesn't work for me. So it's not as relevant. Doesn't mean I can't have a nice time if I'm going with friends or with my kids or whatever. But, you know, it's not as meaningful to me. So the neuroscience of this might be interesting, and I can do it in 60 seconds, which is the brain is making fitting patterns to our experiences. And when that pattern fits into an emotional memory, and a concert is certainly an emotional memory, again, you get that top-down control. I get to re-experience. I get to remember the first time I heard the Rolling Stones sing Started Up on the radio or whatever. And the first time I heard them singing them at a concert, and, you know, I can go on and on. So it's like double or triple what it would be if it was something new for me. So I'll give you one more concrete example. One of the big movie studios who's a subscriber to the Immersion platform asked us to help them use our software to figure out why people watch TV shows in syndication. So as you probably know, you know, all the TV networks and movie studios are conglomerating, and they make a ton of money on syndication. So I'm a big Simpsons fan. I've seen all the Simpsons, maybe not the last 5 years, but, you know, all the old Simpsons I've seen at least twice, maybe more. Why would I ever watch the Simpsons again? Isn't that weird? Like, there's a ton of new content, right? Up infinite content streaming. So what that study showed was that people, because of this memory effect, that when it's a familiar clip from a show, you know, The Simpsons, Seinfeld, Friends, you know, go through the list of classic shows, that people were more immersed in it. Again, it was more meaningful. It's like they had built a relationship with those characters. Where if it's a brand new show, now the brain likes new things, but for new things to generate that emotional connection, you need enough exposure to them, right? So think of this as dating, right? So the evolution is very conservative. There's the same systems in the brain that allow us to fall in love with people, to form friendships, are very similar to the kinds of pathways in the brain that immerse us in entertainment experiences. And so I'm sure when you saw Colleen for the first time, you're thinking, she's super cute. She's really nice. I'd like to talk to her. And then later on, you got to know her personality, and there's lots of things that, you know, had you fall in love with her. But, you know, the first thing, so the attractiveness is the first thing. So same thing with new content or a new song. The first thing is, this is interesting. It's attractive. But I have to kind of develop a relationship with it to really be like, this is my new favorite singer. This is my new favorite band. It takes enough exposure to their music, perhaps in their concerts. So I build that relationship.
And going down walking down that same road of thought, do you feel like the storytelling experience that bands or fans get into, you know, Madonna, let's, you know, look at her, Alice Cooper, I know Ozzy Osbourne did some of this, but just that they take you on a journey. They have themes, they have different outfits. Sometimes they have snakes on stage. Do you think that all helps that immersion even that much stronger for the fan? Or do you think that that's just for the artist to kind of have a theme or an entertainment purpose?
Yeah, another good question, Colleen. So at one level, your intuition is right. So as we add more senses to the experience, we tend to add more immersion to it. So think of, we live in Southern California. So think of, you know, going into the entrance of Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland. Right, you have the music, now you have this kind of musty water smell, you have the darkness, you have the, you know, moving animatronic characters, right? All that is kind of preparing you for this ride, even before you get on it, you know, you're kind of enjoying it, which is amazing. So we actually, you know, we have measured immersion at Disneyland, and you know, for half the attractions we went on, the entrance was more immersive than the ride itself, because the ride's just a ride. But, you know, the whole setup for that is really important. But anyway, specifically to your question, we actually had a subscriber who looked exactly at that issue, and whether if you add in additional, say, theatrical elements to music, you add in a more storytelling, does it actually increase immersion? And it turns out the answer is no. It's about the same, which is sort of surprising. So on our website, you know, people can send in videos and we'll just test them for free because it's just interesting and it's a way to show them what the platform does. And literally yesterday, someone sent in a music video to our platform, which a whole bunch of us watched. I don't even know who the artist is, so I'm not going to trash anybody. But the video was so over the top. It was just weird for weirdness sake. The music wasn't bad, but it was so distracting to have this. It was just too much, too many cuts of just weird, weird stuff. I thought, you know, this is a really nice song, and I feel like you're degrading the value of the song by trying to add in the weirdness. So last example, I saw about 10 years ago, Eric Clapton. There was a warm-up band, a little bit of quiet, and lights kind of go down. And then sitting in a chair in the middle of the stage by himself is Eric Clapton, just wearing a regular old t-shirt and jeans, and he just starts playing. There was no introduction, right? Guitar God, the world's best guitar, nothing. He just started playing because he's that good. You know, I think that would only take away from the music. Although I love the big stage shows of the Rolling Stones, and I've, you know, been to enough concerts, that's kind of fun sometimes, but if the music's great, the music's great.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? If we're our last episode, we talked with someone who was just totally immersed in the performance of David Bowie, you know, and what he would do on stage. And I think back to some of our most immersive experiences, and it's a mix, right? Because I've been immersed with an artist that doesn't have a whole lot on stage, and I'm immersed because, you know, it's simple, focused, and they have such a command over their craft as a musician that they're able to, you know, cast their immersion spell, so to speak, over me and the rest of the audience, just because of their, you know, how they're performing, and the control they have over their craft and where they're taking the song and the moment. And it's interesting to think too about different artists who play the same song the exact same way that you would hear it on the album. They play it exact same way, note for note, you know, everything live, right? U2 is a good example, you know, of that, completely immersive. But then you have other artists like Frank Zappa, right? Or any other similar artists who will do something different. And, you know, it seems like they're all tapping into this different aspect of ways to create immersion. And it's quite fascinating, right? I mean, I gotta imagine it's gonna be kind of frustrating for artists to kind of find out their right mix for their show and how to do that
and how to attract new fans.
Yeah. Cause I mean, we've reviewed a lot of concerts and you know, there's the opening artist, right? The artist you've never heard of. Everybody shows up for the headliner. Nobody, you know, if you go to the opening act, which not a lot of people do, right? But we've seen opening artists who don't have that relationship with the artist. You're like, who is this? And I never heard your music before, but you're in front of me and you're playing a song. And then I'm like, wow, like, okay. Like I want to go pick up your album, or I want to go download it, you know, afterwards, or I might include it in the review, you know, of that. And they were able to connect without any pre-relationship, right? Right. I did mm-hmm. not know them until this moment that you're in front of me on the stage. And I'm like, wow, okay. Like they did something different with the music. But it's interesting to think about immersion in that way. And I got to imagine it's going to be kind of hard for artists to do that. But I guess that's where the agile nature of immersion and what I'm guessing from reading your book and studying it, what you've been saying is that, you know, it's got a little bit of a unpredictability, you know, to it, but is also can be predicted in some aspects.
And it's all who you're with too. I mean, that's a big part of it. Who you bring to the show with you, are your friends there, your family? Maybe it's someone you really don't want to go, but they're the only ones that could afford the ticket at the time. You could be at a small venue and you're just kind of meeting people and it's a great experience, or you're a small venue and you're alone. I think those all play a role. And I know you talked in your book about, you know, that those relationships, and we talked a little already about community. Do you feel like there's a difference between male and female when it comes to immersion?
Oh, another good question. I did want to follow up on the kind of stage show thing real quickly. You know, I even think, you know, I was thinking of Lady Gaga, who, you know, in the beginning was so over the top in terms of her performances. But, you know, you look at her duet with Bradley Cooper, Shallow, it's like 2 billion downloads, literally. So, you know, there's nothing special about that other than it's a beautiful song and beautifully, you know, obviously it's part of the movie, so that's helped promote it, but, you know, it's so well done. It's so tender and, almost heartbreaking. So yeah, I don't think, you know, of all the great Lady Gaga songs, I don't think, you know, I think that's in the top five. You know, it's that good. Yeah. About differences. So Colleen, you said so many, correct things that are, I mean, correct. You have so many things that are consistent with the data. Who you're with makes a huge difference, right? That's the sort of setup. Yeah. Like, particularly when I was younger, and you probably have, guys have done this too, where, you know, like you go to a show with someone who, like, is an ex or someone, you know, or friend you don't really like that much. And you're like, oh, I really want to go to this show, but this person, you know, I got to talk to them, I sit next to them, and whatever. And so it just kind of degrades the experience because, again, you're not getting that energy from the people around you. Whereas, you know, you can go to a little bar, you know, I can just remember some really distinct things. I remember being in a bar in Scottsdale with some really good friends. I didn't live in Scottsdale. And this guy, single guy with a guitar, just extraordinarily good. And again, it's not clear it was I was having a great time with my friends or, you know, the guy was really that good, or maybe both. But certainly, you know, having a great group of friends who had, you know, we all decided to meet there and have a bunch of fun, you know, that certainly added. I was already in a great mood. I was already having a good time, and the music just added to that. So who's most immersed? There's not a strong male-female difference, but we have found that individuals who by their personality traits are more agreeable and more empathic are more immersed compared to people who are less agreeable and empathic. So agreeable and empathic people are warm. They tend to have more friends. They tend to be happier. They tend to have really strong social connections. So they're people. They're the feelers. They're the warm people that you just love being around. And so now about 60% of those, 65% are women, and, you know, 35 to 40% are male. So a little bit of skew towards women, but mostly it's driven by personality, which is interesting. So what's the takeaway for listeners? If you want to go to a concert, bring your super warm, happy, you know, emotional friends who are just going to make it better. Don't go with a person you don't like very much or someone who's boring and dull, and, you know, go with some great people and it'll just be a better time.
And it's amazing how many people we talk to that met at a live show and now are married, or, you know, they met their best friend at a live show, or there's so many connections that can happen over music. And we're also learning a lot about the father-daughter connection and the mother-son connection at live shows, that it's like changed them because they went to a live show and had experienced and were immersed in that live show experience, maybe with their parents' favorite band, or maybe it was the son's favorite band the mom got, you know, dragged to, or the dad got dragged to. And you talked about the Rolling Stones. I have kind of a funny story. I have a good friend of mine that we were just like concert buddies. Like we went to tons of shows together. And I remember one time her parents drove us. This is before we could drive. So our parents dropped us off and we went in to see the Rolling Stones, which I knew them pretty well, but I mean, she was a bigger fan. Her parents influenced her and always had that music on. My parents had other music on, but she would. So we went in and I remember when they were going to pick us up. So they picked us up and we get in the car and she goes, did you guys go too? And I don't know how she, like, what tipped her off. And the dad was like, oh, for sure. Like, we found tickets, you know, some scalper gave us a good deal, and they had better seats than we did. But and so she was there with her dad, not even knowing, but I'll never forget that, because it was multi-generational at that moment of where, you know, they experienced it and just couldn't just drop us off. And if they had that opportunity, they had to spend that money just to experience it. And of course, I'm sure they didn't want to, like, hang out with us, and we didn't really want to hang out with them, but we were there together and we were experiencing together. And I think moments together can be such a powerful enhancer in how that immersion experience is for people.
Yeah, amen, sister. That's exactly what we find, is there's a halo effect, which is if you have a great external experience, it makes you feel closer to the people you're with. And so that can be for good and ill, right? If you think about someone who's dating, first, second, third date, if you really have an exciting experience at a concert, helicopter ride, watching the sunset, that's going to, be worth like 10 dates, because it's that really highly emotional experience. And then it's going to carry over to how you feel about this person, for good or ill, right? So again, this is sometimes called the misattribution of arousal. So I'm having such a great time with this concert with this girl I just met. And then, I'm emotionally super engaged. And then I go, oh, I must really like this girl. So again, you have to be a little careful if you're doing this. But if you really do think you like this other person or these friends or whatever, yeah, it's definitely going to build that relationship. And that's why these, peak immersion experiences increase our quality of life. They connect us to those around us. So not that you can't go to a concert by yourself, but, when you go with people you really care about, it really forms those strong bonds, just like your experience.
And I know one of the key ideas you talked to was about in the book was mundane is equaling unhappy for some people. And and you can maybe comment on that piece. But I'm wondering, I'm kind of jumping ahead, but I'm thinking of Meta, and I'm sure like I am, I'm getting commercials after commercials about Meta and that experience that's coming, that we're all going to be able to join this other virtual reality experience. And I'm wondering if we go into the Meta, or we go into virtual experience, which is a big part of, I feel like, our lives now, is that you can just hop on virtual reality. A lot of people are doing it, especially the younger generations are going on and starting relationships and playing games. And I mean, you can learn an instrument. I mean, there's so much people doing therapy that way now. Do you think that there may get a point where immersion is a choice that someone can just do and have happen through a Meta experience, and that in our everyday life, we're going to struggle to develop that and to reach those peaks?
I think, Colleen, like every good question, the answer is yes and no. We've had individuals and companies measuring extended reality experiences for more than 5 years. So there's lots of data we have on there, and it's discussed a little in the book. It's not always a win relative to a 2D experience or a live experience. So live experiences, I have many more senses involved, right? I have smell, I have touch, I have other things. Now, once XR includes things like haptics, where I'm, feel like I'm touching someone else, I think smell is probably on the way as well. Then I think we can start creating really extraordinary experiences in the metaverse. The difficulty with that, though, is if Meta or whomever is curating this experience that's so immersive for me, my brain doesn't differentiate between that virtual reality experience and my actual reality. It's just input for my brain. And so I'm concerned that people will create these virtual worlds that are so enjoyable, so valuable to the brain, that they're never going to want to leave. And then we're going to, stop making babies, stop falling in love, stop, all the things that keep humans alive.
Stop going to live music.
Yeah, for sure. I think, what's limiting it now is sort of a bandwidth. If you've been on the like the Meta sites, you got half a body. It doesn't seem realistic enough, even though some of the games seem to be quite fun. So I think we're not quite there yet. But when you can just put on a pair of giant goggles, a pair of lightweight glasses, and really have the best thing. So I wrote many years, 10 years ago, I wrote a blog for Psychology Today called Robot Bride. Right. Once we have, chatbots with emotions, and we're pretty darn close to that, or what seem like emotions, why would I go through all the trouble of trying to meet a woman in real life who might turn me down, takes a lot of energy, when I could just fall in love with, a chatbot or a virtual avatar of my perfect woman who will never say no to me, right? So again, there are upsides to having a real, flesh and blood person next to you. But I think for a lot of people, you won't. There was a guy in Japan, I just read this, who actually married his virtual avatar, held a wedding, and then it wasn't on Meta, it was somewhere else. And then they stopped supporting that software. And so now he's lost his, quote, bride. So, very Japan, in my view. But I think it is a concern, right? We spent way, way too much time in these amazing experiences. Then we're forgetting about, hiking up the mountains and watching the sunrise, about even about bad things. The brain really works on contrast. So I do a lot of outdoor activities and, I've had run-ins with mountain lions and rattlesnakes and, twisted my ankle and fell down a embankment, and my dog got caught in a crevasse once. I mean, all kinds of weird things happen that are not pleasant, but they give you contrast for those things that are pleasant. So if we're always in the world's perfect kind of, XR setting, we're just going to lose the ability to really enjoy ourselves outside that space. It's like drugs, right? So, users of illegal drugs acclimate, your brain acclimates to that amount of the drug, and you got to take more and more and more to get a high. So we don't want to do that, right? We don't want to leave in this drug addicted type metaverse situation where I just need the next hit or I can't even survive. I think that's not healthy.
Yeah, you bring up a great topic that we often explore, and that's the impact and the use or non-use of substances before or during a show, and whether or not that makes a good show bad or a bad show good, and everything in between. And I was thinking, with immersion, like what do you think that, when you take a substance, obviously it does those things that we were just talking about. It can heighten or it can, dull or it can, again, everything in between with that. What are your thoughts on, using a substance, and the impact that can have on, a peak immersion experience, or can it lead,
Can dull it.
Good path, bad path. What are your thoughts on that? And do you have data on that, that impact of substances on immersion?
Yeah, man, Chris, this is a great question. I've done, a couple hundred podcasts about this new book, and no one's ever asked me that question. So good for you. I don't have good data on that. We do know the underlying neurochemical constituents of immersion. And one of those is dopamine, which is this chemical that's associated with anticipation, reward, and valuable experiences. And that's the same chemical that is increased, millions of times from its normal level when you take things like methamphetamine or cocaine. So at some level, particularly the stimulants may make that experience feel like it is more immersive. Having said that, my mantra is hugs, not drugs. So I'd rather have that experience be enhanced by the people I'm going with, by my memories of the last time I saw this band, by all the fun things I did when I've heard this song on my own, because the enhancement with drugs is going to be short term, right? So again, if I snorted cocaine and went saw the Rolling Stones, and then 5 years later I see the Rolling Stones again without cocaine, I'm going to be disappointed. It's not going to be the same. So yeah, maybe short term it may enhance it, but I think long term Again, most drugs, you know, have downsides. Marijuana, maybe if you're old enough, if you're over 30, you're probably safe smoking a little marijuana. But everything else is, you know, not so great for your brain, not so great for your social behavior. So, you know, I'm a boring person, and I have very little experience myself because I know what those drugs do to the brain. So I haven't experienced those drugs. So I cannot tell you from experience, and we just don't have enough data for people who've been on drugs. So it's a great question. I should probably study it at some point, maybe not on myself, but maybe on some friends of yours.
Yeah. We would love to be a subject, you know, to go to a show. And if you need live concert data, because it's something we think about a lot and we talk a lot about on the show, is just the you know, and the varying levels of all types of substances, right? It could be alcohol, it could be
caffeine.
Caffeine, you know, one beer and a show, right? Or right. Two beers or the, you know, and then the excess, right? And you know, that's kind of our scope and spectrum of curiosity is all types of substances and what happens, because we've had fans and you know, all different types of people kind of tell us different things, you know, that some people do not want to do that, but some see it as a necessity to enjoy the show and kind of get ready for that. It seems like it's like a elixir or a primer for a good show. And you know, again, reading your book and following your work, I was wondering, well, you know, is one or two beers like helping you get to or increasing your chances or decreasing your chances of having a peak moment?
Or making your friends very angry at you.
Yes.
So therefore making it a bad aversion experience.
Yeah, they're drinking, you're not drinking, like what's, you know, you're not, you know, you don't want to smoke, or they're smoke, like all these different things like right. that has the impact on, you know, they might be frustrated, you know, their band's getting ready to play and they're not drinking, they're crossing their arms, like, come on, like, why? Like,
yeah, you're such a stick in the mud. I just say,
you just ruined the moment for me, right? Yeah. Like they could look at that, right?
Some of the best times of my life have been in bars. So I'm definitely with you. When we finish this offline, we'll design a couple of experiments and let's just do that. Well, if you guys don't mind being test subjects, let's just test that. I think it's a fascinating question.
Yeah, it'd be great. And I want to turn us back to some of the predictive powers that you talk about in your book, and again in the catalog of your work, is being able to use immersion for, you know, predicting certain things, you know, giving companies, organizations, movie studios a way to try to see what, you know, how do they need to design something. And I was wondering a couple things, two questions. The first one was, do you think you could use immersion to predict how much a concert tour would draw, you know, based off of audience, the level of immersion of that particular,
the actual songs, maybe?
Yeah. The performance, like the songs of that, like, you know, Taylor Swift versus U2, you know, you know, a solo artist versus a group, you know, a hip hop group versus, you know, a jazz, you know, group, like just being able to look at them and go, we know what their music sounds like in a recording studio and, you know, on your headphones when you're listening to it on Spotify or whatever, but what about those same bands live? And can we give the studios and the bands an ability or a tool to predict how much they might make, or you know, the level of success they would have with their live show, so they could pick, you know, oh, we're gonna go down this area, right, or down this tour, right? Because they have to spend money and they have to plot their tour, and they're gonna go to certain cities or not certain cities. So I was wondering if immersion could be used as a tool to help, you know, the music industry pick out where to put their tour stops, you know, or, you know, does Alabama have a higher, you know, versus LA, or like, well, just, I don't know, tons of questions, but first question, do you think immersion could be used to do something like that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So pre-COVID, probably half of our subscribers were in the entertainment industry. And so what we did with the movie studios was had them measure immersion while people watched movie trailers, and were able to predict with around 90% accuracy what movie ticket sales would be just from the immersion of those movie trailers, and also could help them target market that. So, you know, they sort of know the demographic, they expect a demographic, but often when you measure immersion, you'll find, you know, 10% of your super fans are in some odd demographic. So I'll give you a concrete example of that. At one of the studios early on, they invited me to come out while they were measuring immersion, and we had just built version one of the platform. Plus, it's kind of fun to go into a movie studio in LA, right? They're like, you want to come out and observe? I'm like, yeah, it'd be cool. So I get to the studio and they're hooking people up, measuring immersion. They're watching roughs of movie trailers. And one of those was a trailer for a comedy starring four African-American female comedians. Awesome. We had a bunch of African-American women in the audience, and we looked at the super fans, neurologic super fans for that. And sure enough, most of those were African-American women, but about 15% of those super fans were middle-aged white males. And they're like, we didn't know that. I said, great. Well, this is, you know, let's collect some more data. If this holds up, then it tells you, you ought to run some ads on, you know, whatever TV channels or YouTube shows middle-aged white males watch, because apparently they really like this movie trailer. So here's the unfortunate or fortunate story. Right when COVID was about to hit, I did reach out to Live Nation and I said, hey, look, we have this tool. It can really help you, as you said, Chris, you know, decide where to go, how much to spend on marketing, help you kind of craft this. And of course, as you know, they went bankrupt. I mean, inevitably, no one was going to concerts for 2.5 years. And anyway, haven't followed up since then. But I would say maybe, I think relative to a movie, you know, concerts, that's a great thing about live music is each concert, you know, even if I go see whatever, Harry Styles in three cities, he's going to be different. The crowd's going to be different. So I think it's going to be harder for us to get a really, you know, sort of 90% accuracy forecast unless we control for all of those things. You know, it's testable. So, you know, I'm a data guy. I wouldn't mind trying to test it, but I'd say for now, it's going to be a little harder than predicting movie ticket sales.
Yeah. It seems like there are so many different variables. Absolutely. And then from a fan perspective, how would you go about helping fans predict, you know, if they have, especially today, right? Like, you know, concerts are expensive and they kind of have to pick, I can go to
a car
this
or go see Taylor Swift.
Yes. Right. Or yes, that's a great scenario. The other scenario I was, but that's also very good. I might get an immersion experience by buying this car, going or higher immersion experience.
Or go on a trip.
Going here. I mean, you could going go on there.
A cruise or some kind of immersion experience on an island versus seeing a live show. It's coming down to that. I mean, it's so costly for some of the shows.
And I was going to say and that's a fantastic scenario as well. I was also going to say that it was more of the, if they had to pick between two artists or three artists, but I love what Colleen mentioned there too, because that's also because they have to pick, they have to make, concert fans have to make these, you know, like a lot of us, we have to make economic choices, right? And a lot of what your work is getting at too is that there's a way to craft that so that it makes it more likely, increases the chances that a consumer is going to want, or somebody, you know, is going to want to.
It's going to be more than their everyday life.
Invest their scarce resources, I guess. And, you know, scarce is debatable, right? It's, you know, it depends on who you're talking to or about. But we all make choices, right? And I'm wondering if fans could be able to use the immersion as a way to go, okay, I got these economic choices. Which one should I do? Which one am I going to get the biggest bang for my buck?
Before they even press click,
before the show, you know, before they click and go, you know, I'm gonna go, instead of seeing Elton John, his last show at Dodger Stadium, I'm gonna go see Taylor Swift, and pay, you know, and
or pay. Lizzo,
or, yeah, yeah, Lizzo, whoever, right?
So I'll give you the neuroscience answer. So there are two things that drive immersion in this situation. One is the memory of all the times you've heard that song or previous concerts. And so if you fell in love listening to Taylor Swift, And presumably you're still with that person. And even if they want to go with you to the concert, it's going to be amazing, right? So again, think of that setting, sort of setting the stage. If you have really great memories, it'll be better. Having said that, the brain also likes new things. And so surprise, one reason travel is so engaging to us. The data show that we like something that's new, but not too new, right? If it's, when I was in college taking like music appreciation classes, I remember listening to atonal music. Man, I'm never going to like that. I find it awful. I don't want to listen to it. It just seems stupid to me. And so, you know, it's not my thing. It's too different. In other words, again, maybe if I was better trained or, you know, I don't know, was more educated or something in music, that would be different. So the reason we want to see Taylor Swift or whomever in concert is because we have songs of hers that we love, and we want to hear the new songs or the deep cuts or some cover she does of some song I heard that's going to be totally different. I mean, a song I know that's going to be totally different when she performs it. And so, you know, we want the familiar plus some of the unexpected. So think about that, you know, when you're looking at the car, the trip. The car is a little different because it's functional as well. But, you know, I was actually talking to my daughter yesterday about where we're going to travel this summer, where I want to go, where I'm going to be. And anyway, I have a bunch of trips coming up. And I said, you know, I'm going to build some vacation time around that. But I'm, you know, I don't want to go too wild. So, you know, I do have a dream to go to Antarctica. I really want to go to the seventh continent. I've been to all the other ones. So I feel like I have to do that. But my kids tell me not to go. But, you know, even Antarctica, it's cold. It's a, you know, there's going to be a plane landing there that it'll be on. I mean, it's not going to be, I'm not going to Mars, right? So, so anyway, yeah, I think the idea is if you have great memories, it's going to be better, but you always want to add some newness in. So the Elton John goodbye tour might be wonderful, but you're going to know every song. You've seen so much Elton John in your entire life. Yeah, it's great. You get to see him in concert one last time, but I would say Taylor Swift's going to give you a better show. And her voice is better now. His poor voice is gone. Think of, you know, the old Sinatra concerts. I mean, I wasn't there, but, you know, watching video when he was like, you know, 5 years before he died, his voice was so weak. His energy was low. I mean, great to see Frank. It would be amazing to have seen him in concert at any time. But, you know, which show is going to be more exciting? Taylor Swift now at her prime or Elton John well past his prime? Unless you have the great memories, if you fell in love, if you bought your first house, if, you know, something happened with an Elton John song and you just love it and you can bring back all those memories. Yeah. I mean, Elton John's great. I'm not trying to put him down in any sense, but think of, you know, what I enjoy and a little new.
And when you have these immersion experiences, say of like amazing concert experience, how long does that last, that feeling of peak? Or, I mean, were we talking like a few days, a few hours? Have you heard of people having like longer effects after leaving a show or an experience like that?
Another good neuroscience question, Colleen. Oh, you guys are smart. Yeah, so the effect, the acute effect lasts for about half an hour. So within half an hour, all those neurochemicals have now kind of washed out of your brain. Having said that, these peak immersion experiences are saved in the brain as memories in a very particular way that make them much more easily accessible. So if you've been to that great concert and then you hear on Spotify that song, you'll remember that concert, the people you were with, how weird it was, the smells, the you know, the breeze, everything that was happening. And so, yeah, you get to relive it kind of for free. And that's why we want to have these extraordinary experiences live, you know, not on TV, not in VR, not simulated, but live. I get all those senses building up that add to the value of that memory when I talk about it.
Well, now, I feel like touch, yeah, go ahead. I feel like touch is such a, I don't know that we've talked a lot about that, but it's such a key part of it. And I can remember this is kind of interesting. Just bringing up now, remembering it is we went to a show, one of our first times. I used to take the photographs and Chris would write about live music. And I remember a show, someone came alone. It was a woman. And one of the songs, she just started crying. She grabbed my hand and was like holding my hand. And then someone else, like, and I'm like, this is, I mean, at first I was a little taken back because I didn't know them, but I'm like, wow, this is a good, and then everyone was kind of holding hands and swaying to the song and how important that is. And I know it comes naturally if you go there with someone you love or with a spouse or a boyfriend or girlfriend, but when it's someone that you don't know and it's just, they're moved by the music to want that touch. I think that's an interesting component in the live music experience that I know we haven't really talked about a lot here. We talk a lot about taste and smell and obviously sound, but the touch, and I'm sure that that's a key part of the immersion experience if you can have touch involved.
Absolutely. So again, the other kind of driver besides dopamine for immersion is oxytocin. And I have a pretty famous TED talk where I talk about the role of touch and hug someone in the audience at the end. So yeah, touch absolutely does it. And think how wonderful this woman was, that she felt so comfortable to grab a stranger's hand. She was so moved, and that you accepted that. You didn't, you know, bat her hand away. I think that almost only can happen when we have these highly emotional, highly immersive experiences. So, it's a very, very special thing. And look how much you remembered it. So that's, you know, proof of principle when, you know, these highly emotional experiences are saved because they're unusual. They're so different than what we have in our normal lives. And they connect us to others. And that's ultimately what makes us happy, right, is our relationships.
Yeah, I think that experience, right? I wonder if you would have remembered that if that lady had not grabbed your hand.
And I don't think so. And I can actually remember because we walked out with her because she didn't have anyone there. And I remember her kind of like connecting with us. And we actually walked out with her. And I remember like her car. And I remember like walking through the parking. I want to think she was kind of scared of where we were at. Like she didn't want to walk alone. And so, yeah, there's a sense of vulnerability that I definitely felt, and I'm feeling she did too. And it was all really based on a live event. It wasn't like I met her on the street, and I don't know that it would have been the same if we did.
Do you remember what band was playing? What show it was?
You're Beautiful. That's all a song I remember. I don't remember the artist, but it'll come to me.
James Blunt.
James Blunt, right. There you go. Mm-hmm. I was trying to get it out too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome.
That was my singing, which is not
that was great.
The best, but
want to feel a little beautiful, feel connected, I think that song is so true in some way, you know. We just want to be appreciated. We want to be recognized for the weird uniqueness of all of us. And I think it's so much easier when we are creating an emotional experience. Again, that's I think why we still go to live concerts, and for that matter, live theater, all kinds of live experiences, because it's just so much more powerful, both individually, but also socially as a group.
Yeah, I think, Paul, if we were able to do that live experience concert experimentation for you, it'd be interesting to see. One of the things I've wondered about many times is that, especially as we were going through your work and your book, was is there a difference in peak immersion from genre to genre in a live music situation, because we often talk about, you know, if you're at a rock show, you know, you'll have a different experience if you're at a maybe like, you know, a heavy metal or like a hardcore punk where there's a mosh pit, right? And there's these things going on where like touch is really taken to this extreme, you know, and there's elbows flying and people are like, this is part of my experience. I'm having my immersion experience and it's really physical, you know, versus, you know, maybe a hip hop show where there's a direct call and response happening from the artist to the fans, and they're having a vocal exchange, you know, in that. I just wondered if there is a different, you know, immersion experience, different levels of peak immersion from genre to genre, and then why. I think that would be really interesting to explore and see if, you know, what different genres can learn from each other, and if they could bring those into that, because I think it's, you know, our musical genres have blended tremendously, but, you know, the live show, as we've gone to, you know, see a all these different shows, and we have all these different experiences. And as we're as Colin and I, you know, sometimes we're spectators of the experience. You look back and go, wow, okay, that's, that would never happen at a, you know, you don't see mosh pits at a hip hop show.
Right.
Well, or I guess country in, shows. I guess in certain, it depends what kind of genre of hip hop. I guess I'll stop. You know, I'll say that because there are certain types of hip hop that do get that. But yeah, or yeah, you don't see mosh pit at a country show.
Right. Yeah, you get 10 points. You stumped me because we haven't done enough live events. I can't tell you, I have an analogy. We were studying meditation a lot in our lab, different kinds of meditation, meditating alone, partially because, again, my professional interest is really happiness and the neuroscience of happiness. And people meditate are happier. They're more present. They learn to manage their emotions better. So we did an experiment. We measured several different kinds of meditation for people who are novices, people who are very well trained. And then we went to a concert in near us in Temecula called Lightning in a Bottle. And they had a meditation teacher there, a guru, and they got 1,000 people to simultaneously meditate. And this is before we had the immersion wearable. So we're actually drawing blood to measure changes in neurochemicals. And so before and after this meditation. And I mean, people were weeping afterwards. It was that social layer just added this extraordinary experience. It was just amazing. So yeah, my sense is if the greater sense of connection, the greater the immersion, but I don't have an experience across all those genres that you mentioned to even make a guess about that. So it's just a measurement problem. We have the tool now. We just need you guys to go to a bunch of different concerts and we'll measure you.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds awesome. Yeah, we talk a lot about that, well, on the show, off the show, but just about the ability to, hook up, MRIs or just see brain activity during various genres, various moments of shows, things would happen, memories, I at one time was looking and doing these experiments on myself where I would, blindfold myself for half of a Radiohead show where I'd never seen Radiohead before. I went to go see them and then took off the blindfold halfway through and was like, wow, because someone had told me that, Radiohead is great sonically, but their live show is really visually, tremendous as well. So I was like, okay, let's test that, and all that kind of stuff. So it's, the senses are definitely at play.
I'm also very curious about the history of where those shows occur and if there's any connection with like where Woodstock happened, right? The farmhouse, like if you did a show there, is there going to be a different type of immersion experience because of the historical significance? Or like, we went to a lot of shows like in the South Side of Chicago, which, a lot of those areas had lots of crime, during that time, or like history of crime. And I don't know. I wonder if you know that going in, if that changes the way you feel about a current event or a show you see because of the historical event of that location or the sacred grounds.
Yeah, like seeing
it. I'm using quotes like sacred grounds for mm-hmm. some places.
Yeah, like seeing a show at Red Rocks versus seeing a show at an amphitheater or something like that, right? Do you see location playing a role in immersion and like Colin was saying, the historical significance of that?
We just don't know. Again, I think it would be, there was sort of kind of an awe experience that happens in peak immersion moments. So like Red Rocks, does kind of invoke this experience of awe. But again, there's lots of variables involved, the people you're with, who the artist is, the weather, all that. So I don't think there's a general rule there, but personally, I do love the outdoor concerts. So, that may just be special to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we wanted to ask you about a couple questions that you had answered on ahead of the show. The two questions we asked you was your the worst concert you've ever been to, and then the first concert you've ever been to. You said that you couldn't remember what those were, and I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, and I was wondering if you feel immersion played a role in not being able to remember those, or if there's something else that stopped you from remembering those.
Or was it just bad memory?
I'm a very future oriented person, and this is going to shock you, but when my children were born, my first one was born in 2000, I decided to stop listening to all new music and stop watching all sports. because I have like three jobs and I'm super busy, and I wanted to devote as much of my spare time to my children. So even I think earlier I said, like last time I saw Clapton, I think my kids were born then. My wife took me to that concert. That might've been 15 years ago. So yeah, I haven't been to a concert in the longest time. That's not completely true. My kids took me to a couple, but it was, you know, their, just like what you guys said, it was their gig and not mine. But you know, I could still pull stuff out from a long ago. That was amazing. So yeah, first concert, I can't even remember, but yeah, Rolling Stones was great. Clapton was great. You know, the unexpected, there's a band in LA called Fits and the Tantrums that my kids got me hooked onto, even though, quote, I'm not listening to new music. They'd be playing it around. And we went to a little concert in Riverside, really small theater. And it was so much fun, partially because I went with my daughter and it was unexpected. Like I knew a couple of their songs. The rest were just weird. And there's kind of this nouveau soul band. And it was just wild. So anyway, that's my story. I know I'm a very boring person.
Did you and your parents do any go to a lot of shows? Was there a lot of music in the house, or was it? Did you have that experience with them?
No, I didn't. My parents didn't listen to a lot of music, and we were kind of lower middle class. I was happy to go to bed with a full stomach, to be honest. So yeah, we didn't travel. We didn't go to concerts. We just didn't have either my interest or the ability. So it was really, you know, once I was kind of out of the house and, you know, maybe starting in college.
It's been great. I wanted to wrap up by asking you, one final question. You know, if concert fans could do three things that would enhance their ability to have an immersion experience or a peak immersion experience, like what would you suggest they do? Or if not fans, what do you think bands or venue owners should do or could do to make peak immersion experiences more likely for fans?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a couple things, and I think some of these may not be intuitively obvious, but they're supported by data. One is to think about putting in an intermission. So immersion is really metabolically costly, and the brain needs a little recovery time. And it depends on the length of a show, but if you're just kind of hitting the brain over and over and over, you actually end up exhausting people. So by the end of a really good show, you're kind of wiped out. So an intermission that may not be bad. Let people get a drink, have a beer, go pee, stretch a little bit. And so I know that's counter to way that most things are run. The second is really kind of setting that stage. And so the Fits in the Tantrum show that I went to, you know, I paid for seats. A lot of people were standing. You know, I'm older, so I want to have a chair. I'll pay for it. But, you know, really creating an environment where people have a chance to be comfortable with each other, you know, be around each other. As Colleen said, like the lady who took her hand, would be great. And then, you know, open as hot as you can. Don't start slow. Get me going right away. Put that energy into the room, and that's going to carry you for a lot of the concert.
Awesome. Well, Paul, thank you so much. It has been fantastic to talk to you, and I feel like we could carry on.
Thanks
and,
for answering all of our questions.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for preparing so much. This was super fun.
Yeah, and we would love to be test subjects out in the out in the wild in the concert arena for you, should you need us.
Well, let's do it. Let's make it a plan.
All right. Thanks so much, Paul.
Live Fix Podcast is a production of Live Fix Media and is produced by Chris and Colleen Catania. Hey, we know every concert fan has a live music story to share, and we'd love to share yours in a future episode. So head on over to livefixpodcast.com and click on Share Your Story. We look forward to hearing from you. Like what you heard? Did you get inspired by the stories of your fellow concert fans? Then help support Live Fix Podcast by subscribing and sharing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. We appreciate your support, and thanks for listening.